endemic and growing problem of maternal mortality within the U.S. can sometimes feel very abstract. In part one of the series, we heard from some real women with real birth experiences that brought them to the brink.
It wasn't until the next morning that my OB came in, took one look at me, and realized that I had been bleeding internally the whole night.
I saw her say the words code blue, and then shortly thereafter, my vision went. I couldn't see anything. And then I remember not being able to breathe. I remember feeling physically hot and then feeling like the room was closing in on me.
We also heard about the extent of the problem and some of its root causes. Today in the US, 7 million women of childbearing age live in counties without access to or with limited access to maternity care. These women are giving birth to more than 500,000 babies a year, and this is putting them at risk of serious health complications.
Socioeconomic factors play a significant role in pretty much all healthcare outcomes, including maternal health outcomes.
Women are often dismissed in general. You're being anxious. It's normal. It's supposed to hurt. We're told that about so many things. And in the end, it can lead to a fatal result.
In this part two, we want to move beyond the problem. Let's talk about some solutions. Community-based organizations, or CBOs, can be critical partners for improving maternal health outcomes for Black women. These organizations engage and provide continuing relationships with the people they serve. So as such, they're well positioned to support birthing people throughout their pregnancy. There is remarkable evidence demonstrating the effectiveness of CBO-led programs to improve birth outcomes, particularly among local Black residents. They can provide a buffer against social determinants of health through advocacy, access to food, housing, and other resources. There are also a significant number of community-based doula and midwifery care and autonomous standalone birth centers, which have demonstrated notable reductions in preterm birth, low birth weight, and cesarean sections. Unfortunately, many CBOs are locked out of traditional funding sources such as philanthropic or government grants, and this is a problem that particularly affects Black-led community-based organizations. Other solutions include the provision of affordable, continuous health insurance coverage. This might include an extension of postpartum Medicaid coverage for up to 1 year to help ensure that key physical and mental health needs following birth are identified and met. Health systems and payers can further address maternal mortality health outcomes by increasing monitoring maternal morbidity measures and undertaking root cause analysis to address any inequities or adverse outcomes and to seek to drive improvement. Yele Alukas, director of the EY Center for Health Equity, spoke with us in the first episode of this podcast series. I asked him then about solutions in place.
Now, the problems in America have been known for a long time. Moving the needle will take a very concerted effort and approach to address these upstream drivers of health disparities. That needs to be done. You know, you have to have upstream strategies that address root causes. And once that is done, concurrently while that is being done, developing new business models that promote population health at large, that promote better access to care, easier affordability of medications and care, preventive approaches, not reactive approaches to human health, you know, and also holding institutions, healthcare institutions, healthcare providers accountable for gap closure. Now that requires investment in infrastructure, investment in technology, investment in digital platforms that provide visibility for performance very accurately and in a near real life fashion. But fundamentally, I think that we require three important things. One, we need consistent and louder advocacy for change. I'll give an example. Advocacy for electronic medical records has resulted in EMRs being part of expectations with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Obamacare was driven through a significant amount of advocacy that led to the second issue, which is legislation that becomes law. So the Affordable Care Act was passed, but it was up to the states to accept or reject. And as of now, of all the states in the United States, I think about 11 have not yet adopted the Affordable Care Act, despite the fact that there is clear evidence that those states that have adopted Obamacare have increased access to larger populations, have reduced the expenditure for healthcare because of more organized care management, and have improved outcomes. This is where I refer to the political determinants of health, because those states that have refused to accept a proven method for improving access and care delivery for political reasons are impacting downstream outcomes of people. And the third thing I want to mention is the enforcement of regulation that demands equitable outcomes. And this is done through incentives for high performers and consequences for low performers. That is beginning to happen now. CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is now rolling out health equity metrics portfolios by which health systems will be measured. And there will be financial incentives and consequences if expectations are met or not met. The same thing's happening with the FDA. The FDA is putting out regulatory expectations for enhanced clinical trial diversity with a similar intent to ensuring that industry stakeholders are including a health equity lens in the business models they devise and the processes and procedures and all the work they do, infusing that lens so that it becomes part of the culture of these organizations.
So Yale, given the state we are in today, are you hopeful?
So I'm an optimist, and I fundamentally believe that there are more good people than there are bad people in America and in the world. So certain things have happened in the past 4 years. George Floyd was killed and COVID happened. I mentioned both of these issues because both of them had global awareness, global reactions. You will remember that when George Floyd was murdered, there were demonstrations across the entire world. Not small demonstrations, there were massive demonstrations as far flung as Asia, Australia, Europe. People were asking questions, what is going on in America? How can a person be murdered in broad daylight and nothing happens? The second issue is COVID-19. In America, the reality that Black and brown people were dying in droves as compared to other demographics was laid bare, not by the health industry, but through investigative reporting, social media, and mass media, 24/7 on CNN, ABC, MSNBC, Fox News, you name it. And people were asking, what is going on in our health industry? And they were demanding answers. We need to also remember that what has occurred in American society in its 400 plus years of existence will not be dismantled in 4 years, but it can be truncated, and it will take policy, regulation, strategy, capitalization with funding, social impact funding, but accountability for deployment of capital, infrastructure development, workforce training and upskilling, and improving health literacy, alleviating the social determinants of health, and so on. So the upstream drivers are mitigated and the downstream repercussions are also dissolved.
We're going to return now to our conversation with Adonica Shaw, a doula, student midwife, and patient advocate. As the founder and CEO of Wing Women, we looked at why now is the time to focus on the problem.
I think right now we stand at a unique time where if we are mindful about priorities, perhaps we can make some change. But again, a lot of this has been ongoing for years. It's just that now we're finally starting to have the hard conversations and look for opportunities to improve and to lean into some of the things that perhaps we haven't been willing to talk about before.
We talked about the importance of education and the use of proper language.
Beyond the education piece, I think there's the component of how do you educate people on something that is very, I was trying to think, like with medicine, we tend to say things a certain way, but then when you're dealing with minority patient populations, perhaps they wouldn't talk about it the same way. I think one of the issues I ran into with preeclampsia is that when I had it and I told my family members and told friends after the fact, everybody was kind of shocked and surprised. None of us had really ever heard of it. I was one of the first in my peer group to get pregnant. And so admittedly, having gotten pregnant earlier than some of them, they didn't really have a point of reference. When I did start to talk to some older African-American women and family members a little bit further down the road, maybe several to 8 months departed from my experience, they said, oh, that's toxemia. And so I think even when you think about moving the needle, and particularly with people that are most at risk, it's also finding a way to do it either by using language that they use or using lay language so that they understand what you're talking about if you're going to move the needle. Unfortunately, for any number of reasons, sometimes people don't have a care provider that is willing to kind of meet them where they're at. And I think that disconnect could be one of the contributing factors in why we're seeing so many women and birthing people struggle with these issues.
I asked Adonica whether more telemedicine could address the areas where actual service was in short supply.
I think digitization could help, but I still think you have to have either a culturally competent care team that is on the receiving end of those calls or texts, or the terminology that's being discussed in those appointments has to be in lay terms. Coming into this space, you know, and I'm by no means an expert, I'm not a PhD or a physician, but I will say at the very beginning of my career path in patient advocacy was a little rough because I didn't understand a lot of the terms that were used. Obviously, I'm far more educated now, but even as educated as I was at the time with a lived experience, it was still difficult to understand and connect the dots with what I was being told. So yes, you can use telehealth, but it's not a matter of just making it available and accessible. It also has to deliver care that the people understand and will be able to leverage to their advantage. If they're getting essentially what would be the equivalent to an in-hospital or in-doctor's office visit where the provider isn't making the attempt to bridge that gap, meet them where they're at, use lay language, or break things down in a way that they feel motivated and encouraged and supported to address their health, then just simply making it tech-enabled or putting a platform in front of them may not shift those behaviors or those outcomes in the way I think people are expecting it to.
As a doula and a student midwife, Adonica is acutely aware of the benefits of midwife and doula care in order to alleviate some of the strain on the healthcare system.
Well, I think doula care is incredibly powerful because you have somebody that is an educator who's also a friend. The interesting thing with doulas, particularly now in the United States, you know, I don't want to talk about the global landscape, but here is there's conversation around the fact that they are essentially non-medical, non-clinical individuals, but also in many cases, they tend to have dual designations. So what's great about the doula care that we're talking about in the forums and conferences is that you have this advocate that comes in and they're able to tell you all of the things about birth, prenatal care, pregnancy, postpartum that maybe you would not have had otherwise. In terms of midwifery, midwifery in the United States varies from state to state. Different laws dictate whether or not midwives can practice, the scope of practice. What I think is really interesting about midwifery outside of the United States is that as a care model, it is more widely used abroad. And I think it's really interesting that in a lot of these other places, they do have stronger birth outcomes than we have here in the United States.
We looked at how the patient advocacy role extends beyond the patient itself and into policymaking.
I found myself on my own lived experience, and my journey took me through all of those spaces, first as a patient advocate, because I had to learn how to navigate the system after my own experience and then into midwifery. So I became a student midwife. And then after going to school to be a midwife, became a doula, you know, and I think for some people, they would have probably been a doula before becoming a midwife, but my path is just very different. But any of those functions, I think is can be very helpful in improving birth outcomes. And generally speaking, the one thing that ties them all together is the component of advocating on behalf of the patient. So that at the very least, I think can help move the needle with birth outcomes and be very supportive of patients and their families. There is a big cost difference. And again, this varies by state to state. Access to doula care is something that people are championing, but up until this point, people have just paid out of pocket. So on the low end, in some places, it could be as low as $450 and the high end closer to $5,000. Midwifery care, depending upon the experience of the provider. So if there is cost associated with those things, it prohibits families that are low risk from having access to either a doula or a midwife. You know, it's something I think there should be more conversation about.
I asked Adonica about what her goals were as the founder of Wing Women and her plans for the organization.
Wing Women is a women's reproductive health company. I started the business in 2021 after a lived experience with preeclampsia. At its core, we were initially an online peer support platform for women with lived reproductive health experiences. I found it very difficult after my healing journey with preeclampsia and the postpartum period, if you will, to make connections with other people who had navigated the same patient journey. I also didn't quite understand a lot of the medical jargon. I didn't understand how to navigate the healthcare system. I didn't understand the difference between doctors back then. And so I figured if I created this online community, eventually I would attract somebody or somebodies that would join in, you know, and they would talk to each other about their experiences. And I figured it would be a great way to build a community, but also learn amongst people who had been through a similar journey. The company has matured and we've pivoted a bit since then. The wonderful thing about it is that, you know, we attracted people that were ready and willing to talk about their journeys. But I feel that as the founder, ultimately, I was responsible for not just giving them the platform to talk, but then educating. Because if you have people with strong lived experiences that still may not understand how to navigate the healthcare system, then ultimately create a forum sometimes where people could share medical misinformation. So we transitioned into like reproductive healthcare programming and education earlier this year, and now into more hard healthcare services. Wing Women does not provide OB care or surgery, but a curated gynecology list, which provides access to screenings for endometriosis, PCOS, uterine fibroids, contraception, infertility counseling, doula care, health coaching, reproductive genetic counseling, amongst other things. I'm optimistic because the conversations are happening. I still, like many other advocates, know how much more there is to do. And it's not even a matter of just having the conversations. I think part of it is getting everybody in the room and figuring out what goals we are all looking to address.
Because birth experience can lead to ongoing trauma, Adonica discussed the importance of talking about that trauma.
It took me a long time to talk to people about it because every time I would, especially in the beginning, I would feel like the physical symptoms of being in that room and my vision would change. I would start slurring, like it would be me trying to talk about it, but then somehow re-triggering my body back into that state. If you experience some level of birth trauma, I almost feel that there has to be some requirement or that there should be a requirement in place that the patient automatically gets peer support, mental health services, help processing the trauma, help explaining to the patient from a medical standpoint what happened play by play. But when you have these severe events happening to women and women of color, particularly, where they're kind of just like, okay, bye, see ya. And there's no way to help them move through them. I think it can be somewhat dangerous. I mean, the way that I responded was clearly going to therapy, working on myself, changing my lifestyle, becoming educated, gone to school in undergrad. But after all of this, you know, went back to school, got into programs at MIT, Harvard Medical, Duke, got into midwifery school, became a certified health coach. Like I sought the information because nobody gave it to me. And I was deathly afraid of what could happen to my body if I didn't get the information, but everybody doesn't respond that way. In college, I was into beauty pageants. I was very much into being seen and to kind of being in front of people and being pretty and like, yes, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do all of these things. And the thing about healthcare is that it's an area where people are selfless. It's where they're unseen. And so this experience kind of changed the trajectory of my life in that I went from being this person who was like trying to be outgoing and constantly be in the mix and on television to really wanting to go into care and selflessly providing access to support because of what happened to me.
Telemedicine, technology, and social media can all play a role in chipping away at this problem. In our last and final part, we will look around the world to innovators and advocates who are developing solutions to their problems, and we will see if here in the US we can learn anything from them. Please join us then.